We're expecting a group of students from Richmond Atonement School, and they're not here, and if they come sometime, I may, I guess, between your arguments, introduce them in court, so I wanted to alert you to that. So I will call 96-1663 Cut v. Giswold, and Ms. Quiggle, you're going to be arguing for the intervener, respondents, petitioners, Cut and Clayco. You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Catherine Quiggle and I represent Cut and Claycomb in this matter. Cut and Claycomb are the purchasers at the foreclosure sale and the successful bidders. I'll just give a very brief rundown of the facts. Foreclosure was started in 1992. Foreclosure judgment was entered in April of 1993. Foreclosure sale was scheduled and held, and Cut and Claycomb in 1993 and Cut and Claycomb were the successful bidders. At that point, they paid in 10% and the balance of the purchase price. After that, confirmation hearings were scheduled, only to be canceled at the last minute due to Giswold's bankruptcy filings. As you know, there were several bankruptcy filings during that time period. Finally, in June of 1995, another foreclosure sale was held, and Cut and Claycomb again were the successful bidders, paid in the 10% deposit. Again, confirmation hearings were scheduled. Two were scheduled. Two were canceled because of bankruptcy filings. Finally, in December of 1995, a confirmation hearing was scheduled and took place. At that point, GMAC, which is the mortgagee, and Giswold's entered into a stipulation whereby the court, trial court, would confirm the sale but not enter that order confirming the sale until January 17th. It is our position at this point, this foreclosure proceeding was taken out of the statutory procedures. Statutory procedures contemplate upon confirmation of sale, the redemption is barred, that order confirming sale is entered, and at that point the purchasers have 10 days to pay the balance of the purchase price. That didn't happen in this case.
Well, did Cub agree to that? Cub and your clients agreed to that?
They weren't a part of the stipulation. They were simply the successful bidders at...
But at the time that this occurred, when GMAC and Giswold entered into this agreement for redemption until January 14th, were your clients aware of that?
They were at the hearing, so they were aware of the agreement. I frankly don't know.
How could the judge enter that order without Cud's approval, without your client's approval?
It was a stipulation between GMAC, the mortgagee, and the debtor, and I'm assuming, and again, this isn't part of the record, that the trial court decided, well, if GMAC, the mortgagee, is willing to extend the redemption period by 21 days, that would be okay.
Why didn't your clients object? They've got rights under the statute at that point, don't they?
The hearing on the confirmation is not part of the record, so I frankly don't know whether they did object or didn't object. At that point, the stipulation was redemption would occur by January 17th.
Do you even know that the stipulation was put on the record at that hearing? I have the written stipulation, which is dated January 25th, more than about a month after that hearing.
It was entered, the order was entered after the confirmation hearing. That was pursuant to the terms of the stipulation.
Well, the stipulation, it's a written stipulation by the parties. The stipulation was signed by the attorney for Giswold on January 12th, signed by the attorney for GMAC on January 17th, and signed by the court on January 25th and filed on the 25th. So are you representing to this court that there was an oral stipulation on the record at the time of the December confirmation hearing?
Again, the December confirmation hearing is not on the record. Yes, I am assuming that there was an oral stipulation at the time of the hearing.
Do you know that as a fact?
I know that the agreement was made at the time of the hearing. And
the agreement was made, but did your clients object? It's another way of saying, did they agree? Did they object?
I don't have the record of that hearing. And so I guess what I would say is...
You don't know if they agreed, and you don't know if they objected.
I know they were there and were present at the hearing.
Let me understand...
You didn't represent them at that hearing.
No, I did not.
As I understand it, now from the facts, that the confirmation that your clients bought this property at the sale sometime, when, in 1994 or something? This is the second time?
Well, the second sale was in June of 1995.
Okay. Then the confirmation hearing, and they bought it at that time.
Yes,
they
did.
And they paid their 10% down.
Yes, they did.
And then the confirmation hearing was held on December 27, 1995.
Yes.
Now, under the law, what was their right at that point? What were their rights? Didn't they have a right to sit? If they had simply come in and paid 90% of that, the other 90%, they'd already paid 10%. The property was theirs.
If the court had not approved the stipulation, yes, they would have had the right to pay the balance of the purchase price. I think the court, consistent with the policy favoring redemption, must have determined that, okay, the two parties, the mortgagee and mortgagor, have agreed for an additional time for redemption. The trial court approved that.
Well, were your clients represented by counsel at this time?
They were not represented by our law firm. I don't think they were represented by counsel. The trial court throughout this proceeding had said they faithfully attended all these proceedings.
Let me tell you what my problem is with your case. My problem is that after that confirmation hearing, your clients, the Cubs, had rights. They chose not to, for whatever reason, they didn't exercise them. And they allowed this, I think, it sounds like an extra legal stipulation between two parties who didn't have any rights anymore at that point.
Well, I think GMAC probably had the authority to say, okay, we're going to give them one last time to redeem. And I think the trial court
Under the statutory scheme with the sale already having been held, and the confirmation hearing having been held, could say to your client, sorry.
Well, at the confirmation hearing, the agreement was it will be confirmed but not entered. And so the effective date...
But it wasn't agreed to by your clients. I'm wondering where your clients were at all.
They were there, and I appreciate your concern about my clients, but I think the trial court would have had the authority to extend that consistent with the policy favoring redemption, and I don't think we should focus on where were my clients at that hearing.
I'm focusing on the statute, the statutory rights that they had, which seems to me they waived.
I don't think they waived them. The court approved a procedure which allowed Gisvolds an extra 21 days to redeem. The court must have determined that was an equitable thing to do. In any event,
Go ahead.
Do you think the trial court could do that even though there was objection?
I think that the equitable authority of the trial court in a foreclosure proceeding is broad. And I think even after confirmation of sale, the trial court has the authority to supervise the proceeding. So I think if the situation was such that Gisvolds could present that, look, we're going to get this thing together in another few weeks, yes, the court may have the equitable authority to do that. The case law is supposed to favor redemption. The point we're at now is that Gisvolds were given plenty of opportunities to redeem. They were given additional opportunity to redeem. And rather than focus on what my clients did or didn't do, I think the court should also be concerned about what Gisvolds did or didn't do.
So now we got you into December 97, and they agreed that the order would be entered on 1/17.
Yes.
Okay, then what happened?
Then, and under that stipulation, the redemption period would expire if Gisvolds did not pay the amount, balance of the purchase price, by close of business January 17th. What happened was is they filed bankruptcy
when?
That January 17th, about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, 1:15, 3 hours before the redemption period expired. The effect of that was to suspend the ticking of the redemption period until either the bankruptcy was dismissed or 60 days had expired from the time of filing bankruptcy.
Let me give you a different scenario. Let's say that the December 27th hearing, which is the confirmation hearing, that the order as a result of that hearing was signed by Judge Lindell on January 16th. That it was signed and entered on January 17th, excuse me, signed on the 16th, it was file stamped January 17th at about 10 a.m., 3 hours before the filing of bankruptcy. Let me ask, if by signing this order and having it filed 3 hours before bankruptcy was filed at 1:15, doesn't that take the property out of the bankruptcy estate once this order confirming sale is signed and filed?
Well,
and then therefore the stay would have no effect if it's, the property isn't subject to the bankruptcy estate?
No, not really, because under the stipulation, Giswold's had until 4 o'clock that day to redeem the property.
Well, the stipulation wasn't filed until January 25th, much beyond the January 17th date. I mean, that makes it all retroactive, well afterwards. I'm talking about if the order confirming sale was filed on January 17th, a little after 10. Therefore, it's no longer any property interest in the Giswolds. It's not part of the bankruptcy estate. They file, any stay issued wouldn't have jurisdiction of property that isn't part of the bankruptcy estate. They don't have any interest in that property anymore because of this order confirming sale. What's wrong with what I'm saying? It makes sense
to
me.
What's wrong is it's not consistent with the stipulation, and because had Giswold's come in and paid the redemption amount after that order was entered under the stipulation, they would have had the right to do so.
We're tied to the record, and at least the record that you're presenting us today is a written record of an order approving stipulation not signed until January 25th. As I understand your comments, the transcript of the December 27th hearing isn't part of the record? Is that what you're saying?
No, it's not. This was an appeal from the trial court's decision to supervise the proceedings and determine the redemption rights. I think we're getting bogged down on the technicalities and what would have happened as of a certain date. I think the court should focus on the overall equitable authority of a foreclosure court and should recognize that this proceeding, you're correct, it did not follow the statutory procedures. And because of that, the trial court has to have the equitable authority to supervise those proceedings. And the case law is clear that a trial court does have equitable authority to supervise proceedings even after confirmation of sale. So I think we can all agree that these procedures did not follow the statutory procedures, and they didn't follow what was contemplated in the stipulation. And because of that, the trial court has the authority to apply the statute in an equitable manner, and that's what the trial court did. It's clear that the Giswolds benefited from having this extra time to redeem. They benefited from filing the bankruptcy, and even with those benefits, they were not able to redeem within the time they had agreed to. I think the court needs to look at what happened in this case and decide whether the trial court has the authority to apply the statute in an equitable manner. That's what the trial court was trying to do, yet it recognized that Cutt and Claycomb did not have notice of when the redemption period expired. They were not creditors of Giswold's. They were not given notice. while there isn't a statutory requirement for notice, the trial court correctly said, well, this is a court of equity. Isn't it reasonable that they should have had notice? And can we really apply the 10-day deadline in a situation where the purchasers do not have notice that the redemption period has expired?
Who should give notice, in your opinion? Who should this court require give the burden of notifying dismissal of bankruptcy proceedings?
I would say either Gisbolts or GMAC. They were the ones who knew when the bankruptcy proceeding had been dismissed. They knew that this stipulation was in effect and that then there would be a period of time within which the purchasers could pay the balance of the purchase price. I think the trial court found itself in a situation where it had to deal with circumstances that did not fit neatly into the statute and, in fact, didn't fit neatly into the stipulation. The trial court said at the hearing, can we agree that this was not contemplated at the time of the stipulation? And that was the case. The bankruptcy filing put the whole matter into limbo, if you will, suspended the expiration of the redemption period. Therefore, it's not equitable to apply this 10-day deadline until the purchasers have notice. I think the Court of Appeals incorrectly termed it a waiver of the 10-day deadline. The trial court did not waive the 10-day deadline. Rather, the trial court said the 10-day deadline can only apply once the purchasers have notice. So it's not a situation where the purchasers are coming in and saying, gee, we can't get the money together, we need more time. They simply didn't have notice, and so the trial court gave them 10 days from the time it was determined that the redemption period had expired.
Ms. Kliegel, let me interrupt and ask you, if I might, a couple of questions. Do you feel that is it your position that the order that was signed by Judge Lundell in January ever went into effect, that confirmation order?
Not until the rights were determined at, it would have been the June 1996 hearing.
Well, didn't the judge sign another order in June?
Of June of 1996 as
right.
Order confirming sale.
And then your clients paid within 10 days thereafter.
Yes, they did.
All right. Now, the order in January, is it your position that that order ever became effective?
No, it could not become effective. It could not equitably be enforced against my clients because they had no notice of their 10-day deadline. The only reason that order affects my clients is because they have 10 days within which to pay the purchase price. I think the trial court recognized that that order could not be enforced because Cut and Claycomb had no notice of the expiration of the redemption period.
Another question, counsel. Check me if I'm wrong, but as I understand the law, once the sale has been confirmed by the court, the original owners of the land no longer have the right of redemption. Is that correct?
Correct. Confirmation of sale generally bars
now,
redemption.
The Gisbolts, and once they pulled their bankruptcy, that last bankruptcy filing, so I understand that the sale had been confirmed, entered on January 17th, at the time that Gisbolts redeemed, was the judgment of confirmation of sale entered?
I believe it had been filed with the clerk of court.
Then why would they have any right to redeem at that point?
That's our position is they don't have the right to redeem. Their right to redeem ended on March 12th when their bankruptcy was dismissed and they hadn't redeemed the property.
But don't you have a problem with that from your client's point of view then? Because your client didn't pay within 10 days after that date.
That's where we get to notice, and that's where we get to foreclosure being an equitable proceeding and the fact that these circumstances do not fit neatly into the statutory procedure. They do not fit into the the procedure contemplated by the stipulation. That is exactly why the trial court needs to have the authority and does have the authority, in our view, to supervise the proceedings. The statute contemplates notice. Notice was not given in this case, and it's not equitable to apply that 10-day deadline when the purchasers have no notice.
What are we talking about in remedy? Should you prevail? Should you prevail here? What do you want? The court to order that a deed be issued to your clients?
I think a deed has been issued to my clients. The situation is, upon staying, the appellate court granted a stay, and we want that deed to become effective.
This is like a quiet title action, isn't it?
Yes.
And that's what the mortgagee is doing. They say, well, let's figure out who has title here.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you are here. So you would like the court to merely say that fee simple is in your client?
Yes, that's correct.
And no interests of who would be cut off? Gisvolds.
Mm-hmm.
What about GMAC?
Well, they will be paid. So
the court also should say that your client owes 90% of the purchase price.
Yes, that actually was paid into court.
Okay.
I believe it has been returned pending the outcome of this case.
Returned to your client?
Yes.
So the 10% is still in?
Yes, it's still on deposit.
Okay, so the order you want is fee simple in you, nothing in Gisvold, and then you should pay the 90%, which will then clear at GMAC.
Correct.
And if you should lose, you should not prevail, then I assume that you would want an order giving you back the 10%.
Yes, we do.
All right.
What factors do you find in this case that lead to the conclusion that equity should be done for your clients?
Again, the factors are this whole proceeding very departed from the statutory procedure. My clients did not have a meaningful opportunity to pay the balance of the purchase price within 10 days because they didn't have notice of when the redemption period expired. Gisvold benefited both from the extension of the redemption period even after the confirmation hearing and by the bankruptcy. And so in weighing the equities, if you're going to apply a 10-day deadline, it just is reasonable to require there be some notice of that 10-day deadline.
Well, you're not aware whether there are some written memos or conversations at the hearings, you say. You don't know if a record was made and we just don't have it?
I wish I could answer your question more definitively, but I can't. I'm assuming that December 95 hearing was on the record. This appeal was from the trial court's order in June granting my clients the additional 10 days, and the December 1995 hearing was not made part of this appeal record, but I'm assuming there is a transcript available of that hearing.
Now, after that first bankruptcy, or after the first sale, I know that your clients put 90% into the court. Was that 90% in the court on the day that that last bankruptcy was dismissed, March 12th of 1996?
No, they had lived with this and put the money in, and I believe it was after April of 94, after having several hearings canceled, that they asked the judge, look, this money is sitting in court, we're not able to get a deed, can we please have the 90% back? And the judge did order that. It was a matter of tying up money for an extended period of time with no...
I understand. It just would have given us a more convenient buck here.
Okay.
I want to focus on who would you have this court rule, not just for this case, but for other cases, have a responsibility to give notice? Is it the person who's filing bankruptcy? Is that, should we set a rule that they always have to give notice, or the lending institution who has the money?
I don't know. I'm not trying to avoid your question, but I don't know that this court has to make a rule such as that. I think under our case law, the trial court has the equitable authority to supervise the proceedings. I think this court should defer to the trial court's exercise of equity as long as the trial court examined the facts and reached a reasonable decision that a reasonable judge could make. Foreclosure is not going to go the same in every single situation, and that's exactly why we let the trial court have the equitable authority to supervise the proceedings. A hard and fast rule isn't going to work in every single situation.
Thank you, Ms. Kriegel. You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Let me just interrupt the arguments at this moment and welcome a Lutheran Atonement School in Milwaukee. Who are the students from that? Raise your hand so we can see you. Well, that's good. And I would like to introduce the court to you students. And I'll start on my far right. That's Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And to her left is Justice John Wilcox. And to my immediate right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice William Babbage. And to his left is Justice Jeanine Geske. And to her left is Justice Patrick Crooks. And for all of you in the room, there are photographs of the court on the table outside, which will give you information about the court, as well as a summary of the case that you are hearing. And you are hearing a case about a mortgage foreclosure and who should be getting this property. And we heard from Ms. Quigel, who represents Mr. Cudd and Mr. Claycomb. We will now be hearing from Attorney Waterman, who represents the Gisbolds.
May it please the court, Ms. Quigel. My name is Michael Waterman. I represent the Gisbolds in this matter. Briefly, let me describe the standard of review I think we need to apply in this case. There are two separate issues in my thinking, my analysis. One is, did the circuit court have the authority or the power to address this problem with the stipulation or this problem with the statutes? That is a question of law. It's a matter of statutory interpretation, which this court reviews de novo. I believe that if the court concludes that the circuit court had that power and had the power to excuse noncompliance, that any exercise of discretion, any exercise of that power is viewed under the mistaken use of discretion, abuse of discretion standard. I don't believe that we should apply that standard throughout the entire case, because we do have legal issues that are our threshold question before we get to any issues as to whether the court had abused that discretion. From our standpoint, this is a case purely of statutory interpretation. When interpreting a statute, we first analyze the plain language of the statute. If there is no ambiguity, then we apply that plain language to the facts of the case. I don't believe there's been any claim that this statute is ambiguous. It is quite clear on its face. The legislature chose to use the mandatory word of shall. And I think that is very important when interpreting the plain language of the statute. They chose the word shall.
What statute are you referring to specifically?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. It's 846.17. And that is the statute that generally controls this issue. It is presumed that the legislature selects its words carefully, deliberately, rather than artfully. That presumption is exacerbated by the fact that the legislature uses words of permissive nature, such as may. And in section 846.17, the court uses both the words shall and may. I believe that it is a matter of plain language interpretation. We can reason that the legislature understood the difference between the word shall and the word may.
Counsel, maybe it's just too warm in here. I'm not catching your argument. What is your point here? Could you give me your point, and then maybe I'll understand why you're distinguishing between shall and may?
The point is that the circuit court entered a confirmation order. That order requires, and by application of the statute, requires the purchasers to tender the balance of the purchase money within 10 days. And that is where the word shall is coming into play. The legislature says the purchasers shall tender the money. It is our position that the statute is mandatory. and that the 10-day time limit is not something that can be waived, can be modified, or disregarded.
Let me ask you a question. Does the purchaser of foreclosed property, must that purchaser be notified for the confirmation of sale hearing?
Yes, and I believe there is a statute section on that point. Section 846.165 requires notice of the confirmation hearing.
Okay, so the person or persons who are purchasing this foreclosed property must be told at the confirmation hearing, and then they would know either if they appear or even by, if they didn't appear by statute, that they have 10 days in which to pay the full purchase price. Is that right?
That's correct.
But it's your position that despite the fact that your clients have, by filing a bankruptcy petition, extended that 10 days to some unknown date, that those same purchasers have no right to know when that 10-day runs?
Well, that brings us to another issue in the case. Was the confirmation order actually entered, and when was it entered? I believe in this case, the stipulation, and there were two different stipulations. The first stipulation extended it to January 15th, which was Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. The second stipulation, which I believe was referenced earlier, is the one that extended it 2 days to the 17th. So that perhaps explains why it was entered so late. But is that entry of confirmation order from January 17th legitimate? Is our position that bankruptcy had no bearing on that confirmation order? It was something that was entered.
But don't the purchasers, if they in fact have statutory requirements to file, to pay the rest of their money within 10 days, shouldn't they be a party to any stipulation? And isn't a stipulation without their signature defective? I mean, don't they have a vested interest at that point? I mean, it seems to me the argument is that you're trying to hold these purchasers to all sorts of statutory requirements, and that some party went into a stipulation extending that time, and there may have been a bankruptcy proceeding. And throughout this whole proceeding, at least in the record that I've looked at, those purchasers are not party to that stipulation. They didn't agree to an extension of the time. There's nothing that indicates they were even given notice of the extension of time, and there's nothing in there that shows if the bankruptcy is effective. So how are they to know under the statute when it is that they have to pay in their money by what date?
I believe the case law regards the purchasers as interested parties, certainly, once they have made a successful bid.
And we know that they're entitled at least to notice, and presumably to appear at the confirmation hearing, right?
Correct. But I don't believe that they have any legitimate or vested property right at that time. I think that's the distinguishing factor here. And furthermore, they weren't a party to the suit. They never intervened.
But do they have a right to know at what by what time exactly they have to pay all their money back? I think as a due process consideration, wouldn't you think that they would have to know when their money has to be paid?
I believe certainly. If they need to know when the clock starts.
And ends, right? And when the clock ends.
Correct.
And what in this record shows that they knew when the clock was going to end in this case? Because we've got all sorts of things going on between bankruptcy and stipulation, but I don't see anywhere in the record that those purchasers knew when the clock was going to end. And it appears it was not going to end when the statute says it's supposed to end, which is 10 days later. I mean, there may have been the stipulation had impact on it, and potentially the bankruptcy had impact on it.
It is my understanding, and I wasn't the trial counsel, so I wasn't involved in these proceedings, but it's my understanding that the purchasers did attend the confirmation hearing. Now, we don't have a transcript of that hearing, and I believe that is because the appellants, appealed from the circuit court decision. This issue about a stipulation didn't become an issue until the petition for review was filed in this court.
But there is a stipulation in the record that extends that 10 days, is that right?
That is correct. Extends the entry of the confirmation order.
Right, which would extend the 10 days. And there's nothing on that stipulation that shows that those purchasers were A, a party to that, or B, given notice of that order, is it?
That's correct. I would surmise that it is in the trial court record on the transcript.
But we don't have that.
We don't have that transcript because this issue was not before the Court of Appeals. It was not compiled at the circuit court level and transmitted at
the... Well, Mr. Waterloo,
I agree that the plaintiffs here did not have a property right until the confirmation of sale was entered. But would you agree that once the confirmation of sale was entered, they had a property right?
They certainly had a property right, definitely.
Okay, now, so if the confirmation of sale was entered at 10 o'clock in the morning, as Justice Bradley has pointed out, and this bankruptcy petition wasn't filed until the afternoon, then they had property right, didn't they, at the time the bankruptcy petition was filed?
I would submit to the court that regardless of when the confirmation order, what time it went in, that they still had a property right, because I don't believe that
the HUDs did. But if they've got a property right, aren't they entitled to notice?
Notice of the bankruptcy?
Of the bankruptcy and the withdrawal of the bankruptcy.
I don't think so, because the bankruptcy didn't affect their property.
Why not?
Because the automatic stay pertains to actions or proceedings against a debtor. And I believe the case of In re Tynan and Johnson versus the Montevideo Bank, both of which were cited by, I believe, both Ms. Quigley and I, stated that it is the opinion of the Seventh and Eighth Circuits that the automatic stay doesn't affect the automatic transfer of property right. And at that time, we have an automatic transfer of property right pursuant to the Wisconsin statutes, in the sense that the purchasers had their conditional interest. It wasn't a fee, simple interest at that point. And all they had to do was pay up the rest of their money, and they automatically had their deed.
Now, just to summarize your argument, as I hear it, and if I'm wrong, I'm sure you'll tell me, your position is that the confirmation was ordered in January 17th?
That's when it was entered.
It was entered. And that they had 10 days from then to pay up.
Correct.
They didn't pay up.
Correct.
The statute says you got to pay up in the 10 days. And if you don't pay up, you lose.
Correct.
Therefore, you Gisbolds own the property free and clear of Cuswold, etc., and that you're not going to give them back the 10%. Who has the 10%?
The 10% is with the clerk of court, I believe, the statute.
Who should get the 10%?
That would go to GMAC.
Okay. And is that your position?
Correct.
All right. Now, why can't we say that January 17th order is invalid? And that it's invalid because it didn't follow the statute. It was held up an extra, 10 days or 11 days for the time of redemption. And then there's a stipulation, but at least the record we have doesn't show that the Cuds and Clay Combs signed it. And so it's invalid. And as far as our record shows, there is no confirmation. 10 days hasn't started yet. You lose. Or you lose and they get an opportunity to pay up. What's the matter with that theory? Your party just loses.
The problem with that theory is that the stipulation doesn't specifically cut off the redemption rights. It pertains to the entry of the confirmation order. So if the confirmation order never happens, or if that confirmation order back in January was defective or somehow invalid, then we don't have a confirmation order.
Right. So?
And then moving down the line to March of 1996, the Gisbolds tendered the $62,000 and therefore redeemed.
Oh, I think maybe you misunderstood, Chief. I think, if I may. What if we were to simply say that the court's order stating the entry of that confirmation of sale, January 17th, because it lacked the CUD's approval, was invalid, and therefore we put this back and order the confirmation to be entered as of whatever date what that was, as of December 27th, 1995. Once that confirmation of sale is entered, your clients no longer have any right to that property, correct? They no longer have the right to redeem.
Provided that they tender the requisite monies, correct.
Your clients do not have the right to redeem. As I understand the statutes and the law, once the judge enters the order, or the confirmation order, only the Cuds have the right to buy that property. The redemption has now, the gizmos no longer have a right to claim redemption.
That's correct. The case law is very clear that once confirmation is entered, the right of redemption is cut off again.
Well, but if the money isn't paid within the 10 days, then the Gizvolds again have a right to redemption because you need to have a new sale.
Isn't that right?
So what Justice Badner says is correct as long as the money is paid within 10 days. Once there's an order confirming the sale, the Gizvolds have no property interest unless the 10 money isn't paid within the 10 days. Then you need a whole new sale and a whole new order confirming sale, and while you're having that new sale and that order confirming sale, again the Gizvolds have a right to redeem the property. Is that your understanding of the
law?
Yes. Let me tell you what's really bothering me. When you strip aside all the statutes, 10 days, confirmation, etc., you know, when you look at this, your clients are playing games with the system. They were fine filings of bankruptcy, and all five were withdrawn. And they're just, to use the vernacular, they're just yanking the system and cut and clay comb around. And why should this court condone that?
I don't think that the court has to condone it. I am not going to fool the court or make some argument that the Gizvolds were attempting to use the benefit of the automatic stay to its advantage. That's certainly the case in this situation. The problem is that nobody stopped them. And I believe that GMAC or any other party to this matter, had they wanted to, they could have put their foot down and stopped this. By doing a number of different things, and I don't want to be counsel for GMAC, but had they started an adversarial proceeding in the bankruptcy court, that would have started an independent lawsuit. I believe that all this matter of the foreclosure probably could have been dealt with in the bankruptcy.
The problem I have with that argument is, as much as I can tell from the record, they were always pro se. I mean, they followed what they were supposed to do. They appeared pro se, and to say the only way they could protect themselves against what appears to be at least an overly use, if not a misuse, of the system is, in fact, to file yet another action and perhaps have to go out and hire a lawyer and file, intervene in a bankruptcy action, that there's no protection in the state court for them when they're doing what apparently they are required to do under the statute, and we've got this game playing going on.
Correct, and I think that had GMAC or any other party wished to, they could have filed under Bankruptcy Rule 9011. That's the Rule 11 equivalent in bankruptcy court. They could have asked for sanctions, they could have asked for equitable relief in joining them from filing further bankruptcies. That wasn't done either.
Counsel, you indicate that they could have filed for sanctions. As I see this record, there is no indication that any sanctions were imposed against the Gizvolds for these filings. Is that correct?
That is correct.
I don't know how controlling this is, but I see a Ninth Circuit case that says state courts are not authorized to determine whether a person's claim for relief in bankruptcy court is an appropriate one. In other words, that the state courts have no jurisdiction to assess whether or not that any yanking was going on here, but rather that's in the bailiwick for the federal courts to determine, and if there was a sanction, they determined it. If there wasn't a sanction, they didn't determine it.
That's correct, and that was our position in this case as well. I believe the circuit court did point out and was troubled by the fact of the repeated bankruptcies. The Court of Appeals made mention of that as well in their opinion. However, that is something for the bankruptcy court to deal with.
Mr. Waterman, what authority did Judge Lundell have to enter into that stipulation, to get GMAC and the Gizvolds to enter into that stipulation on December 27th? What authority? Was there statutory authority for that?
Not that I'm aware of.
Was it then under his equitable powers?
I believe it was under his inherent powers to control the docket. Essentially what he did was, I believe he could have done this, and I've seen the judge do this without stipulation is that stay execution of an order for a certain period of time so that a debtor or some other defendant can put his or her affairs in order.
What's the difference between inherent powers and equitable powers?
Well, with equitable powers, I think in Wisconsin we abolished the distinction between the legal courts and equitable courts. I think we're really dealing with equitable remedies. I think the court's powers are the same no matter what context he's in. It's the remedy that he is providing. I think is what would be distinguished.
An argument can be made that the January 25th order approving the stipulation, which is the only stipulation we have in the record, is, and the stipulation, is meaningless. It's void. A stay in bankruptcy was issued on January 17th. I think both parties agree to that. Therefore, any order entered and any stipulation approving the order entered in violation of that stay is not a valid order and not a valid stipulation. How do you respond to that?
I don't believe that the automatic stay would necessarily prohibit entry or make that that order void. I believe that the order, for all intents and purposes, was made beforehand. That was the final judicial act when it was made on December 27th, and the judge rendered it from the bench. I believe that the stipulation, the only real effect it had was, when is it going to be posted in the court's computer, which really isn't a proceeding against the Gisbons, which is what the automatic stay would protect. It's more of an internal business mechanism of the courts. And for that reason, I don't believe it would be an action or proceeding that would fall under the automatic stay provisions.
I'm not familiar with all that familiar with bankruptcy court, but as a trial judge, I know I'd get these automatic stays, and we couldn't do anything unless you got some relief lifting the stay so we can proceed. And my sense is that perhaps this order entered January 25th, unless there's indication that there was relief lifting the stay after this proceeding, that it perhaps was stayed. That's just my general sense.
Well, I would think that, I mean, the stay is directed at the debtor, things that are happening towards the debtor, whether it be garnishments, foreclosure, judgments. In this case, it's a little different because the court made the order, confirmed the order from the bench on the 27th. And I believe that's what we would look at as far as the automatic stay. That's when the legal or the judicial proceedings ended. There were no hearings after that. There was not there was no need for any further judicial process. And I believe that's what the automatic stay is more designed to protect. Not a situation where something is set into motion, for instance, in this case, where the order is sent into motion on the 27th, and it doesn't reach its destination or finally be entered on the docket until the 27th. And I don't believe that the court's stay in the entry of its order that was made previous is a violation of the automatic stay, because it's not an action against the debtor. It's simply something that the court is handling within its own docket, within its own calendar. With respect to the fact that the Gisbons didn't receive notice, there are two things that we need to keep in mind, and we need to make a decision because there's two different types of analysis that we have to proceed on. The first one is the January confirmation hearing valid? If it's valid, then we need to analyze the statute from that point forward. There's been argument made today that a January hearing was not valid, and that the confirmation order that was entered in June 5 of 96, is the one that's valid, and that's the one that we should look at. And that's where the purchasers tendered the requisite money after that hearing. I would submit that that argument is flawed for one reason. The Gisbons redeemed or tendered the money on March of 1996, before that June hearing.
What right did they have? They lost their rights, didn't they, after that bankruptcy petition was dismissed? Because then the confirmation of sale has been entered.
But I think it depends on what analysis we're going to take. I believe the purchasers have argued that the June confirmation hearing is the real confirmation hearing. That's the one we need to look at. Well, if that is the legitimate, valid confirmation order, confirmation order, and one didn't exist in January, or that one is somehow void, then the purchasers, by definition, have redeemed by paying, because redemption rights are not cut off until entry of a confirmation. I think we need to be aware of which path are we going to take, which confirmation order is the valid order. If the
Mr. Waterman, let's assume that you're right and that your clients win in this. What's your position in regard to the 10% deposit that was put down by the purchasers?
In that respect, I think we need to refer to the statute, 846.17, and the statute is very clear. Interpreting it, we believe that is a mandatory statute with a penalty, and that penalty is forfeiture. And I believe that we can draw a comparison or analogy between 846.17 and a private transaction for real estate. In a foreclosure action, we don't have a contract of purchase that dictates the closing date, that dictates things like earnest money. If we compare 846.17 to a private transaction, we can see the similarities. The 10% deposit being the earnest money, the 10 days requirement being the closing date in the private transaction. And in a private transaction, if the closing doesn't occur, if the buyers breach their agreement, they forfeit, in most transactions, they forfeit their earnest money.
Let me ask you about that. Because since we got the liquidated damages provision, basically, right? What about an argument that, since this is an equitable proceeding, that there would be at least equitable defenses available under this statutory forfeiture provision, and that undue enrichment would be an appropriate consideration, and that GMAC apparently was fully paid, or would be fully paid when this whole thing is resolved, and that in fact there would be some undue enrichment by giving them the additional 10% when in fact they've been paid fully?
I believe the case law states that the court's equitable or authority to effect equitable remedies is not or does not trump the statutes. And you have to look at the statutory mandates first.
Well, it's not an equitable remedy. It's an equitable defense to a provision that you have characterized as a penalty. Just a thought.
I suppose an equitable defense could be raised. In this case, there was no evidentiary hearings about what that equitable defense would be. There has been argument made that the purchasers didn't pay because they were confused about the bankruptcy or they didn't have notice, but there was no findings of fact to that effect. I think for purposes of this appeal, they simply didn't pay for one reason or another. So if that was raised, I suppose that is something that could be entertained by a circuit court.
And the 10% goes to?
GMAC.
Let's check it.
Who will be paid fully, regardless of who the purchaser is of this property, whether it's redeemed or purchased, right? Out of the purchase monies or the redemption monies?
I believe there would have to be an offset, because I don't think GMAC could get a windfall.
Well, but that's the point, isn't it? That the Giswolds are going to pay paying up the mortgage in order to keep the property, right?
Correct.
Now, GMAC is totally paid for, but then you've got $5,700 floating around, right?
Correct.
And you say it's mandated that HUD lose that money. So my question is, who gets it? If you give it to GMAC, they've gotten their whole mortgage plus this windfall. If you give it to Giswold, they've gotten their property. They paid the debt they're due, and yet they get $5,700. So who should get the money? Maybe the court.
Probably in this case, where there are second lien holders, probably have to go to the second lien holders, or second mortgage holders,
mortgages. Or haven't they been foreclosed?
I think we might have to analyze this as if a situation where if the auction price was higher than the debt owed to GMAC.
So the Giswold got this property subject to other liens.
I believe there are other liens out there.
Well, wouldn't those liens remain on the property if the Giswolds get the property?
Depending on how things are worked out, that is correct. They're certainly not out of the dark on this one.
The language of the statute says, shall be forfeited and paid to the parties who would be entitled to the proceeds of such sale as ordered by the court. Is there any room in that phrase, as ordered by the court, for discretion? Discretion in paying the 10% back to the CUDs?
I believe the court would have to to make some sort of a factual finding as to who is entitled. With second mortgagees out there, I believe that the court would have to find preference for those people as being entitled. I don't think they're out of this picture by any means. And I don't think that it is a situation where the judge can give the deposit money to somebody that the judge sees fit or believes would be fair. I think that would be fair to the other lien holders that are out there. Even if the court finds that the circuit court has discretion in this situation, it's our position that the court has misused that discretion in an erroneous exercise of that discretion. There are no facts to suggest the purchasers being in a better position or a lesser position than the Gisbolds. All we know is that they didn't tender the money. So there's really no facts to weigh in that consideration.
Mr. Waterman, did the Cuds, did they have any property rights after the hearing on December 27th, 1995, entering judgment for which, of course, was delayed?
Did they have a property right?
Yeah.
But yes.
What was that property right?
Fee simple, subject to the encumbrances.
And that was as of December 27, 1995.
Right.
So why wouldn't they be entitled to notice?
Excuse me?
So why wouldn't they be entitled to notice when that bankruptcy was lifted? Not under the bankruptcy law, but simply under our...
I notice my time has expired.
You can answer.
Okay. I think maybe I misanswered or misunderstood the question. On December 27th, the Gisbolds had fee simple, not the purchasers.
But that was when the hearing was held to confirm the sale.
Correct. And that confirmation was stayed until the 17th.
Right, but had that been entered on that date, they would have had a property right.
The purchasers?
Yes.
Correct.
So did they have any kind of a... Are you saying they had absolutely no property right, no kind of contingency? They certainly had a contingency, didn't they? That if the Gisbolds did not redeem by January 17th, they had the right to purchase.
The entry of the confirmation order is what gives the purchasers their property rights.
Right. How can that be, counsel? If I made an offer to buy land, then I'd have an interest in that land. And if the seller wanted to do anything with that land, and not have a lawsuit on his or her hands, but they'd have to advise me, whether you call it a property right or any other right. Now that land is subject to that. So once you've got this redemption, or once you've got this sale, you've got people who have interest in this property who have to be notified.
Notified of the dismissal of the bankruptcy or of the stipulation?
Well, that's the issue. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Waterman.
Thank you.
Mr. Quiggle, you've got 5 minutes. Thank you. Just want to cover a couple of things. I think the fundamental error in this case of the Court of Appeals and of the Gisbolds' argument is that the Court of Appeals did not apply the statute or consider the equitable authority of the court in applying the 846.17. The case law establishes that unless a statute specifically restricts the equitable authority of a court, that the court is presumed to have that equitable authority. The foreclosure statutes say nothing about restricting the equitable authority of the court, and in fact, the foreclosure procedures have been applied consistently recognizing the equitable authority.
Kind of cite one case to us that says what you've just said. What would the case be?
It's that State v. XL Management case says even after confirmation, in that case the court vacated an order confirming sale because of a mistake in the numbers in the foreclosure judgment.
Okay, let's assume that the court has equitable authority to do what it thinks is fair. Case like this. Okay, why is it fair for the judge to have done what he did?
It's fair because Cudd and Claycomb had an interest in the property.
When did they have an interest?
As of being the successful bidders and paying the balance of the purchase price. They had an interest.
They took out that money.
Pardon?
Forget that, because they took that money back.
Well, the deposit was left with the court.
But they had the 10%.
So right.
The deposit of the 10% created in them a property right.
Right.
Okay, and then that property right gave them the right to notice.
Correct.
Okay.
The only way...
theory this way, but we can't...
Pardon?
I said this morning, so we can't just say it's not fair.
No, I understand that, but the point here is they had an interest in the property after confirmation. And if the Giswolds didn't redeem by a date certain, January 17th, which was thrown into limbo, but whatever, they had the right and opportunity to pay the balance of the purchase price within 10 days. That statutory 10 days can only be applied presuming the purchasers have notice of when the 10 days starts running.
Counsel, looking at 846.17, the language, which deed upon confirmation of sale shall vest with the purchaser, so clearly they have a property interest upon confirmation of the sale. You also suggest that by paying a 10% deposit, they have a property interest. That's what I heard your argument. What legal authority do you have for that?
Well, that's what they are required to pay to hold to give them the opportunity to pay the balance. I don't know that I can cite a statute, but they, upon being a successful bidder, they have to pay a certain amount down on deposit. The other... The bottom line here is that this proceeding did not fit into the statutory procedure. It did not fit into the procedure contemplated under the stipulation. In that situation, foreclosure is an equitable procedure. The trial court has to have the authority to supervise the procedure and balance the equities. The court did that. The court looked at the equity of redemption. It also looked at the concept of notice, both of which are important public policies. The Giswolds had plenty of time to redeem. They failed to redeem even within the extended period of time allowed by the bankruptcy. Cudd and Claycomb did not have notice of the end of the redemption period. The court found it was unfair to impose a penalty to not allow them to pay the balance of the purchase price within 10 days. To apply that statute fairly requires notice. As far as return of the deposit, in my view, there can be no question that penalizing them by forfeiting the deposit simply is unjust. There is no basis for allowing either GMAC or the junior lien holders from getting a benefit out of Cudd and Claycomb's failure to pay within 10 days of January 17th. Given the confusion of this process, it just would not be equitable.
Thank you, Ms. Kringle. That ends our oral arguments for today. If Lutheran Atonement School can stay a few moments, would you like to do that? The court will have to go into conference.